on in Iraq, you know, close to the Syria border, not too far away. But anyway, what God is doing in her life, and Julie, you've been over there how long before? 6 months and then came back? There you go, yeah. So William's with here today, too. Good to see you, William. Anyway, Julie, I'm going to have you come up and just share. She's got pictures to share. But sometimes we don't know what's going on in other parts of the world, and we need to be informed about it so we know how to pray, we know how to support, and what to support. And so that we know your monies are going to a great thing. So anyway, Julie Bontrager, come on up here. God bless you. Give her a warm welcome.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for having me. It's a great privilege to be here and meet everybody and just get to share a little bit about what God's been doing, at least in my little corner of the Middle East that I was serving at this summer. So how many of you, when you hear Middle East, you think terrorists, war, bombs, refugees, stuff like that? Raise your hand. Okay. All right, so that's kind of what I grew up thinking, too, you know, especially after 9/11. It seems that was really the focus. War on Terror officially started, stuff like that. And I remember growing up, for some reason, I always had a fascination with Iraq. And I just had this idea in my brain that I wanted to go someday. I think it'd be cool. But it was one of those things that you figured would never work out, you know? I mean, you got a war, and they won't necessarily send a civilian in because that would just produce more risk, right? Well, when ISIS invaded the Middle East and started their announced their caliphate and started taking over and everything, I remember hearing about it, and I just felt like I really needed to pray for the refugees. Just more than a couple prayers, you know, every once in a while, it just really lay on my heart. So at that point, I was about 17, and I knew I wouldn't be going over right away, but I also didn't know if there was a way that I could go over. But I was praying, and something inside wanted to still go, you know. I figured the only way over there would be either through the military or through some big humanitarian organization that would require a couple of years experience somewhere else or something like that. Well, one of my friends let me know that he had gone over on a short mission trip to Iraq to work with the refugees, just hands-on, help them with just basic food supplies and everything. And it was through a small startup organization. They had just started a few years, about a year, actually the year that ISIS invaded, they started up their organization, and they just headed over, just right over into the middle of where all the refugees were fleeing from ISIS and set up shop and started helping people. So I started praying about that, following along with their newsletters and such, and long story short, this past February, I went over for a month trip, and felt God leading me back there long term, so I committed to 6 months, was back for a month in that time, but all in all, I was over there for over 6 months working with the refugees. So is that the first slide, or I can't remember. Yeah, I have a few pictures here that just kind of represent, I guess, try to give you all a little bit of a picture of what I did and what the organization that I was with did. So this is a view of the village that we are in. There's a village that has like incompleted housing. They had a building project, and halfway through, the government ran out of their share of the money. They had made an agreement with local business owners that they would give about half of what it would take to put up buildings and businesses if the business owners provided the labor and provided the rest of the funds. Well, about halfway through building these houses, the government ran out of the money, the war started, so the project just sat. So when the refugees ran from ISIS, they ran into one of these villages and were allowed to stay in these unfinished houses. So, you know, no doors, no windows, it was winter, and it gets as cold as it does here, you know, they have snow and everything. So they had shelter, but that was about it. Can you go to the next slide? What the organization over there does, because it is illegal to be a missionary, Kurdistan, which is the area that I am in, it is northern Iraq, they are a little bit more open to Western influence, open to help and such, more than the rest of Iraq. So we are located in Kurdistan, and although it is illegal to be a missionary, it is illegal to proselytize, it is not illegal to be a Christian. They don't mind it if you're a Muslim, they don't mind it if you're a Christian, they don't mind it if you're whatever religion, you know, as long as you don't proselytize. So what we do is we go in, and our way of coming in is to teach English classes. English is a very powerful tool for these kids, because they do learn some English in their schools, but it's not enough. It's kind of like most kids here in America take high school Spanish classes, but by the time they graduate, they don't know any more Spanish hardly than when they started, or a few years down the road, they forget everything. So we come in, and since we are native English speakers, we do more of a conversational English approach, where we do give the kids some sheets, some worksheets to fill out and whatever, but it is more trying to get a conversation going. And of course, the kids pick up very quickly. So this is one of my classes. I had two. I had a total of 6 students. And the whole summer was spent just interacting with them, building relations with them in the classroom. And after class let out, you know, you go visit at their houses and everything and just really get to know them. Go to the next slide. This is one of my students. She is 8, and she is a very studious learner. She has progressed tremendously over the summer. In the beginning of the summer, she would barely answer if you asked her how she is, and now I can hold a basic conversation with her in English, and she does a little bit of translating when I visit her at her house. So, next slide. Okay. So, yeah, so this is kind of what my desk looked like most of the summer. That's actually more organized picture than it was normally. There's papers strewn all over the place, but I found it very challenging at first when I went over, because I had, other than helping my mom homeschool my siblings, I had no experience teaching. So I really wanted to minister to the refugees. I wanted to reach out, and this was the open door that God provided. So I just kind of learned on the fly, and I think it worked out because the kids are learning. So go to the next slide. So some of the things that we do, although English is the main thrust of the organization, they have other things such as like music lessons. This is Shadeen. She took music lessons for a little while, and then the music teacher had to come back to America, so she quit. But it's just through things like this, and can you show the next slide? Things like baking in the kitchen, you know, making cake, making cookies, gives us an opportunity to just have the local kids in our house and interact with them and get to know them and show them that they can trust us, because they have gone through so much. The refugees that we are helping aren't just Iraqi. They are a people group called the Yazidis. They're a minority, ethnic and religious minority in the Middle East. And they are looked down on by most everybody in their area. Their religion isn't Islam, but it does have a few similarities to Islam. Not much, but the Muslims hate them, and they hate the Muslims. So they don't get along, but unless they are in a Muslim country. So for the most part, depending on where they are, they kind of leave each other alone. But ISIS really targeted them because they were looked on as devil worshippers. Their religious opinion, I guess, is that there is a God, but they don't believe in Jesus. They say it's okay for us as Christians to believe in Jesus, but the way they look at it is that that's our way. As Christians, we think that Jesus is the way to God, but their way is going through what they call a peacock angel. And if you listen to the stories, it actually has some similarities to the serpent in the Garden of Eden. However, they would not view him as evil at all, and they would not say that they worship the devil. And they are, as a whole, as a people group, very hospitable, very welcoming. They love, you know, they love having us there. They want us to come to their houses. But there is a very deep need, because they are very under-evangelized and they're not reached out to very much. And the people in that area just don't really like them, because they think, well, not only are they Yazidi, but they're also refugees, and they're also, some cases, they do have to pay rent for where they are, so if they can scrounge up some money, they pay rent, but for the most part, they can live in these houses for free. So some people just look at them as, you know, people living off of other people type of thing. So can you go to the next slide? Yeah, these are just a group of kids that me and one of my friends there met on the way, walking out in the village. So like I mentioned, we wanted to just really build relationships with them. So part of that, because they're very family-oriented, they want us to come to their houses and eat food with them, just talk with them. The ladies especially, like the married ladies and the older single ladies, they, because of their culture, they don't get out very much. So they're in the house most of the time. If they're not cooking or cleaning, they usually don't have much to do. So they really enjoy it when you can just take some time out of your day and come sit in their living room. Even if you can only communicate very basically, they still enjoy it. They love it, you know. So me and my visiting partner were out walking. We come back, and we're walking back to the house, and there's this group of kids there that we had never met before. But by then, most of the kids in the village know hi or how are you or what is your name just because they have siblings that attend class or friends that attend class. And so they just kind of photobombed us and wanted to take pictures and wanted to take more pictures. So it was just a really sweet end to that day. But yeah, I can go to the next picture. Yeah, but the kids there, it's just, you know, they're like every other kid. When I went over first, I wasn't sure if what to expect necessarily except for what you hear on the news. And I knew from people that I had met who had gone over that what you hear on the news is not necessarily the norm for every place in Iraq or in Kurdistan especially. You know, where we are is kind of a bubble, so to speak. We feel very safe, actually. You know, we go out after dark. Obviously, you don't go out by yourself after dark, but we can go walk out on the street after dark. We can drive to town, drive back. We don't have to worry about somebody trying to shoot us, somebody having a bomb planted, you know, in the vehicle next to us or anything like that. So we feel very relatively safe. And because my family, I grew up going to Central America on missions trips and such. So I was kind of wondering how it's going to compare from Guatemala to the Middle East. And I figure there's going to be huge differences, you know, like their culture is different. Their food's different, the color of their skin in some cases are different. But, so I was kind of surprised when I didn't have as big of a culture shock as I thought I would when I got there. Discovered that these kids, just like the kids in Central America, just like the kids in America here, they like to play, they like to laugh, they get angry with each other, they like to go to their friends' houses. Some of them like to learn, some of them hate to learn. You know, they're just people. And their families have needs. Just like families here have needs, their families have needs. Although they have gone through, in some cases, a lot more than we have. There was a story of one of the families that we really got to know. They said that when ISIS came, they didn't have much warning. The area that they were in, where most of the Yazidis come from, is the area of Sinjar. It's about 3 hours from where we are based at now. But they said that they were in their villages, and the Kurdish military, because Kurdistan, in case there's somebody here that doesn't know, is kind of an autonomous country. It is a part of Iraq, but they have like their own government set up. They have their own military and such. So when ISIS was threatening to come in, when it was starting to take over parts of Iraq, the Kurdish military was stationed in Sinjar, and they told the people there, don't worry, you know, we're going to stay here. If ISIS comes, we'll fight them off. You guys are fine. So they said, okay, they'd rather not leave their homes, so they'll stay. Well, some people have different theories about why this happened, but lo and behold, the evening before ISIS came, the military just pulled right out, and they had asked the people there for their weapons, their guns, because the average family has, you know, a gun in their house. And they told them, we need these weapons because they didn't want any risk of them getting shot. They didn't want the people to have weapons in their house and accidentally shooting a Kurdish soldier or anything like that. So the people gave them their weapons. And so the evening before ISIS came, during the night, the military pulled out. and left the people there without any guns, without any way of escape, so to speak, without any way of defending themselves. So a lot of the people just up and left. In the middle of the night, they had to leave. They had to run. Depending on the area that they were in, they didn't have time to grab anything. This one family that we talked to said that their dad woke them up in the middle of the night. He had 7 kids, and he said, "We gotta go, we gotta go. ISIS is coming, we gotta go." So they ran out the door, literally didn't have time to grab their clothes. They didn't have time to grab food. They didn't have time to grab shoes. They just ran out the door and ran to the mountain. And his sister has a heart problem, and so they had to carry her most of the way, and they ran up. There were thousands of people running, thousands of people fleeing. Some of them had vehicles, so they drive, but the traffic started backing up and getting jammed. People would run out of their cars and run on up the mountain, and it was just a perfect opportunity for slaughter. So they, as they're running up this mountain, there's about 75 switchbacks on this particular one. They wanted to get over to the other side, where they would be safer. ISIS just, it was like a trap, and ISIS had just started shooting people and just kind of mowing people down. So thousands fled and thousands were killed, but there were people who made it. So they hid on the mountain, and they were stuck on the mountain, which if you've followed the news several years ago, you probably heard the story. They were stuck up on the mountain for about 8 days. They had little food, little water. Some families did have a chance to grab some food, so they would share what they had with other people. But they were cold, they were thirsty. During the day they were hot, during the night they were cold. And a lot of them had bruises, a lot of them had cuts and wounds that they couldn't take care of. So finally, the Kurdish military did come back after this started happening. And the United States military was able to help as well, and they broke through and were able to drop water and such on the mountain so people could survive until they actually broke through the enemy lines. So a lot of these families that we worked with, if not all of them, have either a sibling or an uncle or a cousin who was either killed by ISIS or who is captured and in captivity right now. And ISIS captured about, 10,000 women and children. They would most of the time kill the men, but they would take the women and the children and they would sell them into slavery. They would traffic them. And even now there's thousands that haven't been rescued, haven't escaped, who are still being trafficked in Syria, in Iran, and such. And so a lot of these families have relatives who are with in captivity right now or who have died. So it's really just for us to be able to be there is not just needed. It's not just needed for people to be there with them, but it's a privilege for us and an honor to be able to serve them. And for them, it's healing too. And we hope that by our presence there, we want them to feel the love of God as well and to find that healing. And it's been awesome in the last couple months, especially. There are several very serious kids who have been asking very serious questions and soul searching and just wanting to find out more about this Jesus that we keep talking about. So you can go to the next picture. So this is a picture of the mountain where many of the Yazidis hid for 8 days and hoped and prayed that they'd get out alive. We had an opportunity to go up and look over the actual city of Sinjar and some of the surrounding villages not a couple months ago, and just stand there and pray and just, think about what God wants us to do. In September, I'm kind of shifting gears here. So for the summer, I taught school there in the main village and got to know the kids there, started learning Kurmanji Kurdish, able to talk a little bit, converse with them, some in their own language. But in September 25, I believe it was, the Kurdistan government decided to hold a referendum. And they are the largest people group who are without their own country. Kurdistan is made up of Kurds, which they are Muslim, not as extreme Muslim as some in the Middle East, but they have been without their own country for too long, and so they wanted to officially secede from Iraq. And since they already have their own government, they have their own military in place, they have some resources, they thought, you know, this is a good time right now. ISIS is almost defeated. It's lost a lot of its ground. ISIS is not the threat that it used to be. It's not the threat that it was last year or 2 years ago. And so now Syria, Iran, Iraq are still kind of busy fighting ISIS, so they figured this would be a good time to have their countries vote for independence and secede from Iraq. And so against most international advice, they decided to hold it. And Iraq told them that if you hold this vote, we're not going to support you. We're still not going to acknowledge you as your own country. It won't change anything. But they decided to go ahead with it anyway. So September 25, they held the vote, and there was something like 92 or 93% of the vote said yes. They voted yes for their own country. So a lot of the Yazidis were kind of caught in the middle because they don't trust Muslims, they don't trust the government, but they are in the middle of a Muslim region, obviously. So the Muslims from Kurdistan wanted them to vote yes for independence, but Iraq wanted them to vote no or just not vote. So they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place again. And so many of them decided to return to the area of Sinjar where they originally fled from, which was now liberated from Iraq. It was liberated last fall, and start trying to build their lives back up there, rebuild their houses, and see if they can get settled in. That way they don't have to vote for Kurdistan, and they can just kind of be left alone, because that's all they want right now, is just to be left alone. And since Iraq is the official government, they figured they're a little bit safer going to Sinjar, which is a disputed area. It kind of depends on if Iraq's military is there or if the Kurdish military is there, who claims that area. So they decided they would be safer there. So many of the people from the village that we were working in, over half of them went back to Sinjar. So along with that, a team of five, including myself, decided to move back with them and just move into their village, one of their villages. We had a student who had been attending classes for about 2 years at the base, and we knew his family very well, and they said, come to our village, you know, we'll get a house for you, we'll find a place that you can start English classes here too, and everybody wants you to come and teach them English, and just come to our village. So we prayed about it, we checked out houses, you know, scouted the area, and so in September, a couple days before the referendum, we decided to move over with them. So go to the next slide. This is the team that I was with. There were three girls and two guys, and we, for the next month, just spent life in the village. Our goal really going in was just to be neighbors. In the previous base, we had come in and most of the people looked at us as an American organization, so there wasn't that. We were friends with a lot of them, but it was more looked at as we have things that they do need a lot of the time. But we weren't looked at, they kind of thought that we were a level above them, you know. And that's not what we wanted, but that's kind of what they think, you know, with Westerners and Americans. So when we went to Sinjar, we just wanted to come in and just, as much as we could, try to show them that we want to be on the same level as them. We're not trying to be a level above. We're not trying to come in with just all this stuff. We just want to live like they do. Can you go to the next? So to the right here is the gate to our house. And this is a normal village street here. Kids going back and forth from their neighbor's house to their cousin's house, playing outside when they don't have school. And so we got to just move in and just be there. And thankfully, we kind of accomplished our goal. The first 2 weeks that we were there, we didn't even start up English classes or anything. We just focused on getting to know the neighbors and just making ourselves at home. And they made us feel at home very, very much. There wasn't a day that went by that somebody didn't come over with a dish of food or with an invitation to invite to their house for a meal. Go to the next slide. So that's what we did. We spent a lot of time at other people's houses, getting to know the families of our students, getting to eat their food, which was very good. This is just a normal meal there. Go to the next slide. And we did joke among ourselves, which there was a lot of truth to this. There was, for about at least 2 weeks, we probably would have had to cook, if anything, only about one meal a day because people were constantly inviting us to their houses for either lunch or dinner. So it was pretty cool. It was a great way just to get to know them, just to come in and experience their culture in a fresh way, in a new way, and get to know them and such. And for them to get to know us and see that even though we come from a different country, we're just people, just like they are. So, next slide. This is one of my friends from across the street, and got to spend a lot of time with her. She'd come over to the house every day and either help sweep the house or play a game of Uno or something like that. So, next slide. So along with that, us girls got to spend a lot of time with the local ladies, which was great. And they had a lot of stories to share. They had a lot of things that they could teach us. Thankfully, one of the volunteers pictured here in the picture can speak their language almost fluently. She's been there for the last year and a half. So we could kind of communicate through her or our own basic Kurmanji. This picture right here is actually a picture of a bunch of our neighbors and relatives, and their relatives, who got together to make food for a funeral. And which, yeah, they over there in the Middle East, I guess, their culture is that if you have a funeral, it'll usually last from anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And the family makes the food, and the people come and eat the food. And some of the neighbor girls will come and help clean up or something like that. But the bulk, the majority of the work rests on the family. And for them, it is an honor to make food for their neighbors to come. But it is also a lot of pressure. So we got to help out one day, just talk with them and try to make their bread, which is kind of a giant tortilla. We got a lot of laughs out of that, and they got a lot of laughs out of it as well, so that was great. But this picture reminds me of another story. When we were there for about, we had just moved in. We'd been there for about a week and a half. And personally, I was really struggling because I had established a lot of connections at the main base, and I had gotten to know my kids pretty well and felt like I was just at that point where, yes, I had been visiting them regularly, but was just at the point where it was kind of past the, yeah, I kind of know you, to the point where we just really get to know each other. And just like that, a team of us decided to move. And because of all the work that you have to go through, getting the right papers to get through the checkpoints and everything, and my name was on there, we decided that whoever's name was on the sheet would go to Sinjar. And there were 5 of us. So I decided, well, I'll go. But I talked with them, and I had been praying about it, and I didn't know, should I go? Should I stay? You know, should I go to this new place and try to make new connections, or should I stay and work on the relationships that I already had? But I prayed about it and didn't really know one way or another, so I decided, well, I'll go, and maybe I'll just help them get settled in, and maybe then I'll come back or something. Well, I was there for about a week and a half, still struggling, still praying, still just having a really hard time catching the vision for that place and having a really hard time missing the people back at the main base, about 2.5-3 hours from there. Well, one morning I woke up. It was a couple of days after. Over the weekend, God had just all of a sudden just shown me something that, I had been praying, and he just kind of sparked something in my heart, kind of a vision for the place. And it gave me, an excitement, a new drive to be there and a reason to be there. So I was really excited about it, and I was, ready to jump in with what God had shown me. And just started that, and one morning I woke up and I hear this loud wailing really close to our house. It was just wailing, and I was kind of, you just wake up and you're kind of wondering what's going on. And soon after that, I heard a couple gunshots, And I was like, oh, I bet somebody died. Because over there, when somebody dies, they fire a couple rounds into the air. I don't know if it's just to announce to the rest of the village or what it is. But yeah, so I go outside, and it's early morning. It's about 6:30. And I go up to our roof and kind of investigate. And there's the rest of the team's up by then. And we keep hearing this wailing sound. And there's more people crying. And come to find out, the neighbors right across the wall from us had had a death in their family. So at that point, we had had a little bit of interaction with them. They would send over fresh yogurt in the mornings and such, and some pieces of bread. So the girl who knows the most Kurdish went over to find out what had happened. And I was going over in my mind, I was like, well, who died, you know? Like, they don't have all that many old people in the house, so there's probably not, maybe there's their father passed away or something. Well, the story was that they had one of their daughters, she, out of 13 kids, most of them had already moved out, been married for a while. She had a problem. She was 14 years old, and she was having some stomach aches, so they took her to the doctor a couple hours away, found out that there was something wrong with her appendix. So they kept her, she stayed in town for a while, they're just kind of observing her. Well, one afternoon she lay down for a nap, she woke up and her stomach was swollen. They rushed her to the hospital, found out that her appendix had burst, so they quickly started operating, but it was too late and she died. So the family brought her back that morning, about 10 o'clock they came in, and because they don't embalm them or anything, they bury them the same day that they pass away. So it was honestly awful. It was a terribly hard experience. Not just that, it was something I don't ever want to experience again, because people, their neighbors, some of their relatives were coming, and everybody was just crying, you know, just weeping and wailing, and they thankfully do let their emotions out. They don't try to hide their sadness, but it's still something overwhelming when there's a group of about 20 people and everybody's crying at the top of their lungs, and they bring the body into the house, and that's it. That's the last time they see their daughter. That's the last time they have a chance. They didn't have a chance to say goodbye. They didn't know that the week before, that when she left to go to the hospital, that she wasn't going to come back again. So we got to go to the gravesite with their family and watch them bury her. Just be there for support. It meant a lot to them that their American neighbors had come and just shown some support to them. So over the next few days, we really made it a point to go over and visit them, be there for them, try to, you know, just laugh with them if they felt like they needed to laugh, let them cry if they felt like they needed to cry. And over the course of the next few days, it felt like I really had a connection with that family and was just, yeah, they started to feel kind of like my own family, found a lot of similarities in their personalities, and it was out of the tragedy of it all, God was starting to do something, you know, starting to open the door to their hearts, and they were starting to ask questions, and we were starting to be able to share Christ with them. So I was really excited about that, but the fact remained, which was the part that made it the worst experience I've ever had, was that when they were talking about their daughter, or when we had gone to the gravesite, or when they were crying over the body, was the fact that they were crying without hope. They didn't have any hope of, not any true hope of seeing her. In their religion, they do have the belief that most every other religion does, that if you're good enough, then maybe you'll get to heaven. So they were hoping that they would be good enough that they'd get to see their daughter again, and that their daughter was good enough that she would have gotten to go. But because you and I know that Jesus is the only way, we knew that they weren't grieving with hope. So that made it really hard and just really made that desire burn stronger to be there and to reach out to them. Can you go to the next slide? Well, there was about the next week, we received news that due to the Kurdish referendum, Iraq was having some issues with Kurdistan, obviously. They didn't want them to become their own country, so they sent in some of their troops to the Sinjar area. So we woke up one morning to the news that the Kurdish military had once again pulled out of the Sinjar region where we were overnight, and that the Iraqi military, and with them a militia, which is backed by Iran, was going to be coming in any day and taking over the checkpoints. They weren't expecting any battles necessarily, because the Kurdish military had left, so there wasn't going to be much of any resistance there. But the fact that they had a militia that was backed by Iran made us pray a lot, because it was around that same point that Trump had declared that the Red Guard was a terrorist group, and that did not make Iran happy with America. So although Iraq itself didn't necessarily have a problem with Americans and usually welcomes their help, Iran had a very big problem with it. And the fact that this militia was backed by Iran made us wonder if we should stay or if we should go back into Kurdistan. So we prayed about it and decided that for the time being we would stay. But these verses meant a lot to me. It says, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress." So during that time, I struggled with a lot of fear, obviously, of what if the military comes? What if they find out there's Americans? What if that's a problem with them? What if they try to use us as political pawns? What if, you know? Or should we stay or should we go? So for the time being, like I said, we decided to stay. The next day, we had a chance to go visit a family who we had just met, share a meal with them. And the husband shared that his sister, who came over for lunch, had been having these really, really, really bad headaches and such. So she told us the story. She said about 7 years ago, she was laying down on her mat, taking a nap. She looks up, and outside her window, she sees this really, she said he was a really, really tall guy dressed in black and red and just looking at her, and she freaked out. She's like, "There's somebody outside my window. There's somebody out there." She runs outside. There's nobody there. And literally from that day up until when we saw her, she had been getting really bad headaches, had been getting these blackouts. Sometimes she would just black out and wouldn't be able to do any work. She was at risk for fainting. She couldn't lead a normal life. She was struggling with depression. Doctors put her on medication. She went to all kinds of doctors. Nobody could do anything for her, and she kept struggling with this. So we were talking about it, and we're saying how, you know, we believe in healing and such. And so they're like, "Well, can you pray for us?" And we said, "Yes, we'll definitely pray for you." And the brother's like, "Well, why don't you right now? Like, just let's pray right now." So we gathered around her, laid hands on her, and prayed. And while we were praying, she had a blackout. She fainted and was out for a couple minutes. Came to, she asked us to keep praying, so we kept praying. And she kept saying, "It feels like something's stomping on my head. Like there's something stomping on my head, and it's not going away. My head hurts. It feels like it's going to explode. It's awful." So we kept praying, and we just commanded it because we knew this is very demonic, definitely a demonic back thing. We commanded it to leave in Jesus' name. When we finished praying, all of a sudden she just looks, and she's like moving her head around, and she's like, "It's gone." She's like, "There's nothing there." She's like, "The pain is totally gone. I don't feel anything." She said, "I feel okay. I feel good again." So it was awesome. It was amazing. We got to share with them that it was through Jesus that this had happened, you know. So the next morning, we got news again that there had been some fighting close by our village, and we kept praying. That night, we individually took some time out to pray and see if God wanted us to stay or if he wanted us to head back to the main base. Next morning, we all decided, we all felt in our spirits that we didn't have peace with staying. So we decided to go back to the main base and join the rest of the team there. We were hoping for a week till things settled down. Things didn't settle down, and we were there for a month, month and a half, and then I came back to America, and the rest of the team is there now and starting to work on papers to be allowed to go back into the region. Since then, the fighting has stopped. The things have kind of settled down a little bit between Kurdistan and Iraq, but there's still a lot of tension. And there's still a lot of need there in Sinjar, and our team is hoping to get the right government papers to be able to go back and minister to them again. But through that all, can you go to the next page? Next picture. Yeah, so I went back to teaching and got my old students back and was able just to, yeah, keep working on building those relationships again. Next picture. So just kind of wrap this up. What I'm planning on from here on out, I had committed to 6 months with this organization. And towards the end, as my term was coming to a close, I wasn't sure if I should extend it or if I should go somewhere else. So our team did a weekend of medical training, just trauma relief things, the TC3 course, Tactical Combat Casualty Care. so that we'd know if their fighting broke out or if we'd be in disaster area, how to quickly help people before they could move on to the hospital. So our team went through a lot of exercises. Next page. Just kind of, yeah, tourniquets, treating wounds, wound packing, stuff like that. So I was praying about it, and right now I'm in the process with looking to go back with the ministry that did the training for us. So if that happens, I will hopefully be heading back to Kurdistan early part of next year, possibly. I want to do some medical training before that. Want to take a course or so, and that could take a month or more to get through that. So I am looking back to go back with them. Their focus is more, very much still ministry, still building a relationship with people there, but it's more geared towards medical relief and trauma relief, things like that. So can you go to the next page? Yeah. This quote really stuck out to me. Somebody had it at the house. It says, "It always seems impossible until it's done." Nelson Mandela said that. And I was thinking back to when I first remember as a kid wanting to go over to Iraq, and then when I heard about ISIS crisis in 2014, and I was just like, you know, there's no way, so to speak. We're Americans. How in the world am I going to get to the Middle East? And the verse kept coming to mind, you know, with man it is impossible, with God all things are possible. And so looking back over this whole summer, it just proved that again. You know, it seems impossible a couple years ago. And looking back now, it's like, no, anybody can do it. All you need to do is sign up with an organization and head over there, or support the people who go, or pray for the people. That is such a powerful thing. Go to the next slide. And not only does it just, are all things possible through God, but it also, God, in his word, he says, I can do. He tells us this. And I believe Paul was writing to the, I'm not sure which church he was writing to at that point. But he said, I can do all things, not just I can do all things, but I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So we know that with us it is impossible, but with God everything is possible. All things are possible with God. So yeah, I think that is all I have to share about my summer. If anybody kind of went over time, sorry about that, guys. But I would love if you guys have questions. Yeah, feel free to shout it out, and I'll try to answer it the best I can.
Julie, I have a question. Do we have other missionaries in that area that been there before you came? Is there other ones that are in the area?
Yeah, there are. Before I personally came, or before the organization that I was with came? Yeah. So the organization that I was with, they were back in 2014. They were there. And ever since then, they were there. The first team that went more as a crisis relief. And then they went on to other areas. And so there's a branch, the branch that I was with, stuck more in that village to build long-term relationships. And there are other ministries in the area as well. Yeah.
I had heard that you needed different articles, that the Kurds were very open to quote-unquote Christians coming over there and helping the Kurds.
Mm-hmm. It does. The Kurds, it was interesting as we were coming through from Sinjar to the main base. We had to go through the front lines. We actually passed through a checkpoint that was manned by the Hashdul Shabi, which is the Iranian-backed militia. And by God's grace and favor, we made it through without too much of a holdup. They were really taken aback that there were Americans in the area, but we got through. And once we got through their checkpoints. We went through another. We got to the front lines where the Kurdish military had built their, you know, mounds of dirt, their berms and stuff, set up their gunning trucks and tanks and everything. And we get to that checkpoint, and the guy looks at us. He's like, "Americans!" It's like, "Welcome!" Says, "Americans are our brothers. Come on in. Like, come on in." It was just an amazing, just the contrast. So the Kurds are very open. They actually say they want more Western influence. They want to be more like the Westerners. So they're definitely open to that.
Here. How is Israel
You know, I'm not sure if there's an actual like Israeli organization, but when over the summer when Kurdistan was talking a lot about becoming their own country, about every other major, including the United States, major country, I advised them against it. They said it's not the right time, you should wait, except for Israel. Israel gave their full support. And Kurdistan has often identified themselves with Israel, saying that we are kind of like them, where Israel was a stateless, you know, those people had no country for a while. And they say in the same way, we as Kurds haven't had our country for years and we want it now. So they actually would identify themselves a little bit with Israel in that sense. Yeah, that could very well be. Yeah. I can't give the name of the village. I can afterwards if you want, just because live stream recording, stuff like that. But yeah, but we are in northern part of Kurdistan. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them, the refugees, don't have jobs. Some of them are able to, like some of the families would, the guys would kind of go however they have work. One of my students' fathers was like a bricklayer. He would help build the houses and such. But he would often, there would be periods of time where he didn't have any work. It was very inconsistent. And a lot of the others don't have jobs and they just kind of exist. So the government does give them some money. The UN has done distributions as well. So they kind of live off of that type of stuff, but yeah. Yeah. Somebody over here have a question? Yeah. Well, their school, their actual school, or yeah, that just started out. Actually, their school year runs pretty much the same with us as does their seasons and everything. So they started school in last middle part of September. They go, let me see. Yeah, they have 5 days a week, but they take Friday and Saturday as their weekend. So they either go to Kurdish school or Arabic school. Kurdish school is in the mornings from 8 to 12, and Arabic school is in the afternoons from 1 to 4 or 5. So they only have a half day of school 5 days a week. Yeah. And then during the summer, they don't have school. Just go play or come to our house for English classes. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I think they call it like the Red Crescent or something, where, yeah, they have like this path. And that was the issue with the hostile Shabi coming in. They're backed by Iran, and they were hoping through this that they would gain more ground, and they have gained more ground. And they're that much closer to Israel and having that completed. So, yeah, definitely keep praying for the people. Does anybody else have any questions or comments? Okay. Well, thanks a lot for having me here. It's been pretty, it's been a great morning. Great just being able to come and, worship with you guys and share a little bit. And, I have my laptop set up out there just with pictures. I have some prayer cards. I didn't realize there were so few of them there, but if you want to pick up one of those, really appreciate it. Have some information on the back, a blog that I keep updated because of where I'm at. I don't like to keep a lot on social media. Try to keep that very, very untraceable, so to speak. But also, if you feel like God's leading you to give either towards funding my trip back or, there's some information, PayPal, go through there. Or if you have other ways of giving back, something I really encourage, challenged again with last weekend, is I'm sure we all know, and like you said, there's a lot of people who want to do this, but they can't find it in themselves to do it. Do what God is laying on your heart to do. If that's giving, give to somebody, whether that's your neighbor or whether that's the clerk at the grocery store, if it's a word of encouragement, if it's a hug, if it's a meal to a family who's struggling, or if it's going somewhere, go. God will open the doors. God will make the way. But definitely keep. And I know you guys do. Keep keep seeking God. Keep seeing what he wants you to do in your corner of the world. So thank you very much, and God bless.
When I found out when Julie spoke Friday night and shared over at their church, I couldn't make it, so I called Henry and go, is she doing anything Sunday morning? No. Good. We'll have her come. But you know what, Julie? Thank you so much. And the Middle East right now is such a focal point for prayer. We really, really focus on that to really pray for that country and for Israel and all that, because it's all lined up to prophetic what's going on in the world. But this has been really good because, like Holly said, a lot of times we don't know what's happening in the world because you can't trust the news. You can't listen to the news. But to hear what's happening over there, what's going on, is so important to us. And so you're always welcome to come and share here anytime. We'd love to have you. But what we're going to do is we're going to take up an offering for Julie, but write it out to the church and then